Well, nine letters, angry speech. The answer to this clue is our next topic today. I'm sure you got the answer, crossword. It's been just over 100 years since Arthur Wynn first offered his creation in the pages of a New York newspaper. But ever since, devoted and casual fans take a daily crack at deciphering clues and writing the answers in those little squares. How this particular puzzle form evolved and every twist and turn it's taken since 1913 is chronicled by Alan Connor in his new book, The Crossword Century, 100 Years of Witty Wordplay, Ingenious Puzzles, and Linguistic Mischief. Alan Connor is, among other things, a writer for BBC News and The Guardian, and he joins us this morning from his home in London. And Alan Connor, welcome to Up to Date. So nice to have you.
Hi, Steve. Thanks so much for having me. I'm pretending in my head that I'm with you in Kansas City.
And that's a nice place to be. I hope you can be here soon. Well, also joining us this morning is KCUR's health editor and, more importantly, puzzle aficionado Dan Margulies. And Dan, nice to have you too.
Wonderful to be here, Steve.
Alan, start us off with a brief history of Arthur Wynn. He considered himself a journalist. So how did he end up creating puzzles?
Oh, dear old Arthur Wynn. So he was a Liverpudlian. And he fancied being a journalist. His father was the editor of the Liverpool Echo. And like so many people at the turn of the century, he decided he would go and make his fortune in the New World. He found himself in New York. He did end up working for a newspaper, but the poor soul wasn't reporting or uncovering anything. He was working on the section of the New York World called Fun, which was the puzzle pages on the Sunday. And so he would fill these up with word searches and things like that. Come Christmas 1913, he was told that Fun, there'd be even more fun than normal. It was going to be a double-sized Fun edition. And I suppose the choice he faced was either invent a new kind of puzzle or get fired. So so he came up with this thing of a sort of a grid. He didn't call it a grid. It doesn't look exactly like a modern day puzzle. What he came up with, it's a kind of strange diamond thing, and it came with this instruction saying, fill in the small squares with the words which correspond to the following definitions, because they didn't even have the language of crosswording then. So he needed to hold people's hands a bit more. So yeah, this was his creation. He hoped it was going to be big. He asked his bosses to help him with the finance to patent it. And they said, this is just some silly fad, Arthur. It'll blow over in a few weeks. And little did he know, 100 years later, we'd still be doing them and talking about them.
Well, I was going to say, and for a decade, the crossword, as you put it, existed exclusively as an American phenomenon. Indeed, it existed solely within the pages of the one newspaper. What broke the stalemate and managed to elevate its status, Alan?
I think it was two things. In the New York World, there was this kind of small but loyal audience of people who loved these puzzles. The two things that made it big were Simon and Schuster, Mr. Simon and Mr. Schuster, who had a publishing company, and the kind of inevitable American love of the fad in the mid-1920s. So Mr. Simon and Mr. Schuster had formed a publishing company, and they had everything except some manuscripts. So they wanted to publish something. They were aware through one of their niece, one of them had a niece who was addicted to the New York World puzzles. And they thought, well, we'll give these a go. We won't use the name Simon and Schuster because we don't want the very first book to be published under our names to be some silly, trivial collection of puzzles. So they borrowed the name of their telephone exchange, and Plaza Publishing put out this collection of puzzles, which came with a free pencil. And America being what it was, always on the lookout for a new kind of craze. This was the one that caught people's imagination. And 1925 was suddenly the year of the crossword, with there was a Broadway review.
Yeah.
With people sent to a puzzle sanatorium because they were addicted. Women were wearing black and white checker earrings and glasses. The popular songwriters and Harold Lloyd was doing crosswords in his movies. It was suddenly, it was ubiquitous.
I want to bring Dan into our conversation, but Alan, just quickly, the popularity of, the crossword sort of changes the career of yet another aspiring journalist. Her name was Margaret Petherbridge, I guess. Her connections to the puzzle are multiple, as are her contributions to the form. Tell us about her start and where she ended up.
Well, she was stuck on the New York World Fund section as well. I presume she turned up to work.
That was the place to be.
It really was. Yeah, I think I presume what happened was they gave her a job because she was bright, but being bright wasn't enough. She was also a woman. So they said, right, you can check Arthur's puzzles. So she was, I suppose she was a kind of copy editor for a few years of Arthur Wynn's puzzles. But what happened then was when Simon and Schuster had their books, they essentially poached her and said, look, we want you to put these puzzles together. And, you know, as she'd been looking at these puzzles in the New York World, she'd started to realize, she had quite a steely eye, I think, she'd started to realize the difference between a satisfying and an unsatisfying puzzle in terms of the clues and the tone and right down to the construction of the grid and how many letters you're going to have, how many words of which length are going to appear. And I would say Margaret Petherbridge, who ended up becoming the puzzle editor at the New York Times, has as much of a claim to be the kind of progenitor of the crossword as Arthur Wynn, because, you know, he came up with the shape and the idea of putting words into squares. It was Margaret who made it a fun and satisfying and addictive experience.
Well, fun, satisfying, addictive. Dan Margulies, join our conversation here. How much time do you spend each week on crosswords, Dan? And do you solve them in the newspaper as well as in books? Or how far does your interest go here?
I spend way too much time, Steve, on crosswords. I'd like to think a lot of time on each puzzle that I do. I just do too many of them. I'd like to think that I do them pretty quickly. I do them in the newspaper. I'm an old-fashioned kind of guy. I'm an ink-stained wretch, as you know, having been a print reporter for 30 years nearly, and a colleague of yours at the Star. And I just can't get used to the idea of doing the puzzle online. I have to have the tactile feel of the newspaper. I have to have the smell of the newspaper. So I do it the old-fashioned way, pen and paper or pencil and paper more usually. And I am, I confess, addicted to crossword puzzle anthologies, which my good wife keeps in stock for me, keeps me out of trouble. But, yeah, I do spend too much time on them, I'm afraid. And I very much appreciated Alan's book, which I read last night. It's a wonderful and quick read. Particularly the historical parts of it, which talked about, you know, the craze, especially during the 20s, and how the moralists in society were denouncing this new craze as an utter waste of time. And
Maybe they were right, Dan. I think they were right.
It may be, but, you know, it's so edifying, and it is such a fun thing, and it is addictive in a way, I must admit. But in a good kind of way. I mean, it's a benign activity. It does nobody any harm.
What makes a puzzle good for you? What do you enjoy about a good puzzle? What has to be in it?
A good puzzle is one that relies not so much on arcana and obscure knowledge as wordplay, clever wordplay, as Alan's book points out, that relies on resourcefulness, creativity, the inherent ambiguity of the English language, misdirection, red herrings, that challenges you mentally.
Yeah. Let me get our listeners involved here with two questions. Crosswood fans, tell us, pen or pencil? Tweet your answers to us at KCUR, at KCUR Up to Date. Also, tell us what you enjoy most about a good puzzle. What is it? You can call us with that answer, 816-235-2888. I want to make sure I'm using the correct terminology as we move along here, Alan. The person who creates the puzzle is the constructor, and the person trying to complete it is the solver, although you write that an earlier term for them was solutionist. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that solutionist didn't really catch on. They didn't really know. As I say, there wasn't really a language to begin with. When the first puzzle came out, there wasn't even the word grid wasn't used in the English language. It was World War One and the use of maps then that led us to call things grids. But yeah, in America you call them constructors. Over here we call them setters or compilers. I quite like constructor because there is an architecture to a puzzle. You know, they do have to think in this, in that same sort of way, and it's hard graft. So I like constructor.
Let's look at why clues can be so tricky, Alan. I mean, in the chapter that's titled Wicked is a perfect example. Did you mean the verb that describes drawing away moisture or the adjective that denotes something as being evil?
Well, or the third the third definition of wicked, which you find occasionally in a crossword, you see it in clues like a supporter of wicked things. And you think, what are these wicked things? You get a few letters and you go, well, the answer is candlestick. Oh, a supporter of a wicked thing. Mm-hmm. The beauty, I suppose, is using these words in a way in which they could mean either thing, and the penny doesn't drop until you've got some of those crossing letters and suddenly you go, that's what it is. And I think that for me, that's the pleasure of a great crossword or a great crossword clue, is you're sort of willfully and willingly saying, lead me down the garden path, take me to mislead me. Hmm. And then when the penny drops, the experience can be the same as hearing a good joke. Your brain has to suddenly vault from one place to another, and it's that jump that you suddenly have to make. It's the same sort of tiny little rush you can get in your head if someone's done a very good pun or a very good gag.
You know, Dan, Alan writes that English is a language that abounds in ambiguity, and crosswording is a language that exploits this haziness. How much of the satisfaction for you of completing a crossword comes from figuring out, you know, exactly, you know, which meaning a constructor intended for any one clue?
Well, that is precisely whence the satisfaction derives, Steve, is you're basically pitting your wits against that of the constructor. Now, as Alan points out in his book, a good constructor has to be fair and give you a fighting chance. So when I alluded before to, you know, obscure kind of knowledge, unless you have that knowledge in your head, then you don't have a fighting chance. Whereas you may not know the answers to particular clues that consist largely of word play, but you can figure them out. You can deduce them. You can, through the process of elimination, arrive at them. So the greater satisfaction is derived from solving this. And the same, I mean, these are riddles, basically. And you get the same satisfaction and edification from answering those as you would any kind of puzzle that stretches your mental muscles.
So in the world of texting then, Dan, you know, abbreviations and the 140-character tweet, how important is it to have an extensive vocabulary to get through one of these things?
Gee, you're asking the wrong person, because people in this office will tell you that I need to be mentored in social media, and it just ain't my thing. Mm-hmm. Coming from the background I do, and maybe it's not your thing either. In that world, well, you know, that's just not a world that really resonates so much mm-hmm. with the crossword puzzle solver, I don't think.
Yeah.
Or the cruciverbalist, as we like to say more fancily. To the extent that social media, and particularly Twitter, places a premium on concision, that is one of the hallmarks of a good puzzle, mm-hmm. concision.
What makes for a good puzzle is our question on the table here. 816-235-2888 is our phone number. Byron from Prairie Village, good morning.
Hi. I have a comment. I think that the crossword puzzles in the early 1900s may have been more simple. But my grandmother was born in Indian Territory, Oklahoma, in the 1800s, moved into southern Missouri, and had access to a newspaper at the library, and started working crossword puzzles. She never went past the eighth grade, but she educated herself by looking up words that she didn't know what they meant, that were crossword puzzle words. And finally, in her later years, my grandfather, my aunt, my father, my mother, and I were all college graduates, and she always did better than we did.
Huh. Good for her. That's a good memory, Byron. I'm glad you called it in. Thank you.
Thank you.
We're talking about crossword puzzles here on Up to Date, and a new book that's out. It's titled The Crossword Century, 100 Years of Witty Wordplay, Ingenious Puzzles, and Linguistic Linguistic Mischief. The author is Alan Connor, who joins us this morning from London. We're also joined by KCUR's Dan Margulies. You know, Alan, you devote a chapter in the book to one man by offering this explanation. If the clues in a British crossword appear to be the kind of gobbledygook from which only a masochist could derive the slightest pleasure, it might help to bear in mind that Britain is a place that has made a heroic institution of an otherwise little-known cleric for a kind of speech impediment. Tell us about that good reverend. Who are you talking about?
Mr. Spooner, or the Reverend Spooner. I wasn't quite sure how well known he already is in the States, or whether you do.
Maybe a little.
I've seen him come up in a crossword context. But this was a tutor at the University of Oxford who had a strange speech impediment, which first manifested itself when he announced a hymn that the students were going to sing. And instead of saying "Conquering Kings, Their Titles Take," he said "Conquering Kongs." And the undergraduates cruelly fell about with laughter. And he made many slips of the tongue that were a lot funnier than this. Some of the funniest ones were probably made up by the students about him. But apparently he would say things, instead of saying "you've wasted the whole term," he would say "you have tasted the whole worm and you must leave by the next town drain." So this way of kind of mangling the sounds at the beginnings of words, it can be funny and it can be silly, and it's quite fun to put these to try and recover the phrase that was meant to be said. And so crossword compilers will use these sometimes in clues, like those they refer to the outcome of a battle mm-hmm. as a way of getting to a film star. So that'll be Custer beaten to get you to Buster Keaton. And one thing I find particularly interesting about crossword clues that use these things called spoonerisms mm-hmm. is that human beings are very good at them and derive pleasure from them. Computers, and yes, there are computers who try and solve crosswords, computers aren't so good because they can't hear the words when they see them. They're recovering things from a word bank, but more crucially, they don't derive any pleasure from it. They've got no kind of impulse mm-hmm. to go and decode these spoonerisms. So when computers are entered into crossword tournaments, it's playful, silly clues like the ones that involve spoonerisms that slow them down, thankfully, and let their flesh and blood competitors have a fighting chance.
Beth wrote us this at KCUR up to date. She likes a mix of pop culture and general trivia. That's the recipe, she says, for a good crossword. Ben tweets us his answer to the question of pen or pencil. He says, always pen. Or an iPhone. So let's pretend, Dan, that I'm actually doing a crossword and I come across a clue that I don't have, you know, any clue to the answer, you know, pun intended there. If I go to a resource book to look up some obscure river in Italy, am I cheating?
Okay. Well, you know, this is an entirely subjective thing, Steve. I don't do it because I consider it cheating and because I get no satisfaction out of looking things up. If I can't do it through my own wits alone, without the help of external aids, then it isn't a thing for me. But other people will do what they do. Mm-hmm. You know, if it isn't cheating to you, go ahead and do it. Nobody's looking over your shoulder.
So how do you feel if you start off on a puzzle and you can't complete it? There are white spaces left at the end. Does that sort of put a dent in the day or what?
So far, that hasn't happened to me very, very often.
You always complete it?
Almost always complete it,
yes. Get out of here.
No, almost always complete
it. Even the Sunday Times puzzle, you'll complete.
The Sunday Times puzzle isn't particularly difficult.
Oh, God.
It's actually the Friday or Saturday one that is much more difficult than the Sunday one.
It's Friday and Saturday?
Right. Those are the toughest ones of the week. The Sunday one is always themed, and it has a bigger grid, typically 21 by 21 squares, as opposed to the weekday, which is 15 by 15. But Friday and Saturday in the New York Times are typically the most difficult, although I brought as an example a wonderful puzzle that was somewhat difficult from last Thursday in the New York Times. I'll tell you about it in a second. But to get back to your question, I just don't like to look things up, except after I've completed a puzzle and I have some question as to whether I have a letter right, because I'm not certain of the word either going across or down. Mm-hmm. That rarely happens. Then I'll look it up retroactively to see if I got it right. but I never look up the answers whilst I'm doing the puzzle.
Alan, how about you? How do you deal with that?
When I'm stuck, if I'm stuck, I look it up. And I suppose one difference is I'm quite often doing British puzzles, which if any listeners have seen those, they have far more of the black squares in them. So you've got much less of a chance of being able to fill in an answer or get halfway there from the crossing answers. Mm-hmm. And what I figure is, in an ideal world, it's unarmed combat. It's just you just use your brain and you fill the whole thing in. But it's not always an ideal world. And if you're a beginner and you're just getting to grips with the kind of things that are in a crossword, then sure, go look things up and learn. And then you'll have more fun later on. And also, yeah, I would say towards the end of a puzzle, especially if it's a tricky one, I don't think there's anything to be gained.
Right.
I doubt anyone gets a rosy glow from saying, well, I couldn't finish that puzzle, so I just left the white space there. I didn't educate myself about what I was being asked about and found I was ignorant about. I simply walked away. Google it.
Alan, real quickly, what's a Nina?
Ninas. I love Ninas. Ninas are secret messages that you get sometimes in crossword puzzles, which the constructor hasn't announced. So every so often you might find that that your eye catches that there's something going up the diagonal. And of course, the clues only go across and down. And constructors would do these for various reasons. They might it might be a purely private thing of saying a happy birthday to a spouse. It might just be equivalent to those things that they call Easter eggs in DVDs, computer games. Something that's there, and if you find it, you get more pleasure, but you don't have to spot it. And every so often, there was an episode of The Simpsons which had where Lisa was filling in a puzzle, which was in fact that Sunday's New York Times puzzle.
Right.
Ninas in that puzzle was if you looked up the diagonal, you saw it was all F's and D's and E's and C's, that is musical notes. And if you were to try and sing the diagonal of that puzzle, you'd find yourself going bum 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 bum. So it's playful, silly things like that.
Do Ninas become pretty apparent, Dan, as you're working a puzzle?
Well, sometimes they don't even become apparent until after you've completed the puzzle. I mean, that's been known to happen to me where the theme didn't emerge until after I actually completed it. You would think that you need to know what the theme is before you can complete it, but sometimes you do complete it and then say, oh, yeah, the penny drops only then.
Yeah.
And sometimes there are themes within themes, meta-themes, if you will, and you don't notice those things until later. And if I have a moment on this Thursday puzzle, last New York Times last Thursday's New York Times, it was very ingenious. The theme is somewhere in the middle. It doesn't announce itself as a theme. It just says the clue is 39A. It left part of itself in 11 states in 1980. And the answer is Mount St. Helens.
Oh.
And then what you have in 11 different squares in the puzzle are 11 different rebus squares. That is squares that contain more than one letter. And you derive that from this key, Mount St. Helens. These are squares that have the word ash in it, 11 times corresponding to the 11 states.
Yeah.
So you have phrases that contain the word ash in it, like a short leash. That's one answer. And another answer is Texas Hold'em, which contains the letters A-S-H in consecutive order.
Let me get Kevin from Parkville, who's calling us this morning. Kevin, good morning. You're on Up to Date.
Well, thanks for ruining that puzzle for me. It's in my archive. I haven't done it yet.
I apologize. I forgot that the Star runs the Times puzzles 5 or 6 weeks later.
Speaking of crosswords in print, I'm wondering for both your guests if they think that as the population ages, the popularity of crosswords will diminish.
Interesting question. Alan, what do you think? And go quickly, if you would.
I think that that's a danger, and I think that newspapers need to stop hiving off their puzzles into a separate pay-for package, because otherwise, how are you ever going to come across one by chance?
Dan, what do you think?
I think that they get more popular as people age, actually, because my mother lives in a retirement community, and I see people doing crosswords there all the time.
Yeah. Well, Alan Conner's new book, The Crossword Century, 100 Years of Witty Wordplay, Ingenious Puzzles, and Linguistic Mischief. Alan, what a pleasure to have you. Thanks for taking some time.
Thank you so much. I've had a blast.
And KCOR's Dan Margulies. Dan, nice to have you, too. Thanks for coming in today.
Likewise, Steve. I had a blast.